Welcome to the Expanded Podcast with your host, Lacey Phillips. As a leading manifestation advisor with a process that's, well, radically different from the old New Age model, mine is rooted in psychology, neuroscience, and my energetic gifts. I created this podcast to help you expand your subconscious limiting beliefs about the potential of deserving the manifestations you're calling in. Therefore, you're tuning into this podcast series to show your subconscious that anything you desire is possible. And by pressing play, you've already started the process of manifesting it. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us our review, comment, and share it with your fellow manifestor that's struggling or could really benefit from the information that you're about to learn. So we're kicking off this episode with another My Magnetic Story, where I share the community's manifestations. And I'm actually really, really excited to share this one. I'm really excited to share all, but this is from one of my very first clients that I worked with when I actually launched my sessions 3 years ago. So here it goes. You guys, the manifestation I've been working on for the last 3 years finally came through. I'm so excited. I manifested my own apartment. Back then, my list was a studio in Greenpoint for $1,000 a month, I know, which is really unheard of if you don't live in Brooklyn, with lots of light and a great kitchen. But I manifested a one bedroom, lots of exclamation points, with great light, a great kitchen for $1,600. But I know the landlords and they're going to let me babysit their kids. I've done this before for them to make up for the extra $600. So 3 to 4 nights a month. There we go. Now she has a one bedroom for $1,000. Okay, going back to her. So I don't have to budget for paying more and end up paying what I originally intended. Ooh, I'm over the moon. I really started to work on my relationship with money and recently got a ping that if I made a big purchase I was considering, it would help me level up my relationship with money and create some magnetism. I had always had a lack relationship with money, but I had the funds, so I did it, and my place came through 2 weeks later. Yay! So I actually know this manifestor really, really well, and just to give you insight, I don't ever intend that people should go into debt in order to feel wealthy enough, therefore they attract more money. That is superstition I like to demystify. So what she's speaking about here is that when we are trying to open up, when you're working through opulence and we're opening up new portals and we're jumping off of cliffs, one little thing we can notice, if it's within our means and we have the money, that if we know if we're getting a ping to push the envelope financially a little bit, it communicates, especially if we've done all of the work in opulence to up-level our worth, it communicates to the universe that it's like, I know I deserve this, and I know you're going to meet me there. And to give you an example, hers was renting a car for a week when she flew out to California and had to do a trip, which is something she would have never done. But she was like, I have the money. I know if I do this, it'll level up and communicate that I'm ready for these bigger things in my life. So huge congratulations for anybody out there that's manifesting an apartment or a house. You'll cruise over to the pathway where you'll access all of the workshops starting at $24.99 a month for all of them. And you'll want to work through opulence and you'll want to work through the formula magnetism, all of which she's done and many before her. The trigger I want to talk and work through today is the trigger of needing to control everything in our lives. And a lot of old New Age manifestation rhetoric talks about control means contraction, but a lot of people don't know why. I mean, obviously in the conscious mind, we understand that that means that we're not open and flowing and allowing things to come through, but actually it goes down to a far deeper root energetic that when you're working through these workshops, you really want to look at this instead. The need to control is communicating that you don't feel worthy enough. And worthy is the underlying word here because it's something that really has to integrate. You don't feel worthy enough of security, really. You don't feel worthy enough that your life can be secure, safe, and steadfast. So the worth is what you're really wanting to work with there. It's not being contracted, which obviously the beautiful symptom that will come out of this is that you'll open up and flow. But the way that I would really prescribe working through this is doing the daily reprogramming exercise. Obviously, that's just a great way to start out, that you can look at all the ways you're controlling right now with the specificity of when you're down there. Why don't I feel worthy? So for instance, if you notice that you're controlling, let's say your partner, you know, you're having control of your partner that day and micromanaging them or, you know, nagging them, what's really going on below is you don't feel worthy of them showing up for you and you surrendering the control to just allow them. And so that's a perfect way to take it through the daily reprogramming exercise. You'll take it through those journal prompts and then you'll go into the hypnosis and you'll reprogram it. So that's one way you can chip away at it every day if you want. And also at the same time, you'll be reinforcing the new neural pathways of feeling safe, secure, and steadfast, which will ultimately open you up and flow. Another really deeper dive you can go, since you'll already be in the pathway and you'll have access to all of the workshops, I would recommend first starting with reparent. I would go through reparent with a very specific focus of why don't I feel worthy enough through every stage of my childhood? Why don't I feel worthy enough for security, safety, and a steadfast life? So when you go through each of those stages, you'll just lightly have that as a focus and you'll rework through literally pre-utero all the way to 25 with different magnetic parents if you need than what you had. Mine change all the time when I work through it. You know, they've been many variations of different parents, but you'll want to take it through each phase. And then after that, a really good remedy is to continue the daily reprogramming exercise when you notice a trigger come up that you're controlling something. And then ultimately, I think the real goal is to get to a place where we can just be pretty present, right? Because if we're not controlling things, that's what starts to lead into presence. Therefore, if we feel worthy enough that our life is safe enough, steadfast enough, and secure enough, we don't really need to control much more. So this is all about worth. It's not about being contracted. The beautiful gift is that you open up that contraction after, but you really want to focus on the worth when you're dealing with this, and a lot will open up to you. I like to say that this is the pivotal moment where manifestors start to just sit back and be who they are, and a lot of things flow into them. So it's a very specific form of magnetism when you reinforce this enough. So that's the beautiful thing to look forward to at the end of the journey of the work and doing it consistently until you feel like you don't really need to control much anymore.
I think it said like it was fun and then it was fun with problems and then it was problems and then it was problems with problems and it was that kind of thing. It was like whack-a-mole, you know? Whereas when I went to treatment, they said, oh, you were switching seats in the Titanic. That's what they call it, you know? In the end, the ship's going down. So once you get past the point of using exogenous sources to change your reality, then it behooves me to find ways within myself through my spirituality to change my perception of life. Negative thoughts are like enemy soldiers, and if you let them dig and entrench into the field, they're really hard to get to. I find that having, like, again, a more zoomed out worldview makes me take all the little nuances of our societal problems a little less seriously. I don't feel as compelled to go save the world in that naive sense. It's more like, how can I bring light right now when I walk in 7-Eleven?
Today's guest, Luke Story, I have had the pleasure of being on his podcast twice. So if you haven't listened to those episodes, you're definitely going to want to cruise over there and listen to those after this. The first one was just a generalization of my story and manifestations and tools and practices. And then the second one is totally, totally focused around money, where you get to see us outline through his life, his blocks, what he needs to work on, a lot of mic drops on money in general. So I really highly recommend listening to that. That just came out last December. Now, Luke, if you don't know him, you absolutely will after this. He's incredible. His podcast is such a hit. I think my very first friend that introduced me to it was Meredith Baird. And then I've gone on to receive every friend like sending me episodes after, because he interviews all of the people that you guys love within the sphere of wellness and biohacking. I would deem him one of the leading biohackers right now that are on par with all of the big ones we all know about. So I'm really excited for you to expand, learn about Luke's past. So it's incredibly expansive if you come from addiction. It's incredibly expansive if you, it took you a while to really get into your purpose and your flow. How to be an entrepreneur, how to start a podcast, how to biohack. I think many of you will enjoy this. So sit back and tune in. Welcome to the Expanded Podcast. We're here today with Luke Story. And if you haven't already checked out, I'm on his podcast twice. So go listen to those now because it's an incredible podcast. My friend Meredith Baird actually introduced me to your podcast officially, I think, year and a half ago.
Really?
And she was like, you're going to love this. You're going to love all of the guests. And I totally fell in love with it. So when you reached out to me, you were one of the few people's podcasts that I knew. And I was like, oh my God, yes, I absolutely, what an honor.
That's so cool. And it was it not your first one? The
you
first
know,
podcast?
Yours was my very first one. Yes. And then it was like an avalanche after that.
Yeah.
So
that's
many.
Good. That's good. I like getting to people first. I've had the opportunity to do that a couple times where someone creates content in a different space. They write, they do videos, something like that. Authors or obscure doctors or scientists, and no one knows about them outside of their field. And I'm like, oh yeah, there's this whole thing, podcasting. Come on in.
Oh, it's the best. I think it's, and it's the number one digested medium, I think nowadays.
Yeah, because you can multitask.
Yeah.
I listen to podcasts. I think I could honestly say, yeah, every single day I listen to a podcast or a portion of one.
Well, let's get into it.
Yeah.
Let's get right back to the beginning. Tell us about your cultural upbringing, which I know, but let's tell the listeners your background and your cultural
upbringing.
I'm
so excited to be here. I enjoyed our first two conversations, and I love being able to talk more because when you're the host of a podcast, you know, I'm always struggling with, I'm like, have this inner voice, shut up, Luke, let the guest talk. You know what I mean? Because my shows are more conversational anyway, and it's just how I roll, but it's nice to be like, aha, okay,
yeah,
now.
Like, the mic is mine.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun. I'm 48. I've had a colorful life. I always say my hippie mom moved from Berkeley to Aspen, married my cowboy dad, and that's how I've always kind of started the origin story. But recently I visited my mom up in Sonoma County, and she was like, God, I hate when you call me a hippie. Like, hippies are gross.
Wow.
My mom was like a mod.
Yeah.
You know, really.
So she was a beatnik.
Yeah. She was San Francisco, 60s, you know, and she's like, ooh, hippies like were on the street and, you know, did
like
heroin.
Having
and
sex with everyone.
Yeah. She was like, oh no, hippies were like dirty. I wasn't a hippie. Stop calling me that. And I was like, well, mom, you don't get it. Now in this generation, like, hippies are super cool. Mm-hmm. We look at Woodstock and we're like, dude, your mom is at Woodstock. That's so cool. She's like, yeah, it wasn't really cool, you know? So mom was not a hippie. I called her a hippie because when I was a kid, there was like incense smoke and pot smoke in the air around the neighborhood. And the Eagles were always playing. And, you know, it was a very 70s kind of vibe. Floral dresses. I don't know. To me, she's a quasi hippie. Anyway.
Yeah, sounds like it to me.
Yeah. So she, and very, you know, very liberal, forward thinking. But she went to Colorado, fell in love with my dad in Aspen, who was a super rugged cowboy, ski patrolman, stock car racer, rodeo star, just a phenomenally textured man. And then they only lasted till I was about three, and then I moved back to California with my mom to the Bay Area where I grew up. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. We lived in pretty, I mean, you know, it wasn't like Compton, but we lived in pretty downtrodden neighborhoods, low income neighborhoods. And my dad had money, but I didn't live with him except on vacation and stuff like that. So I got to, you know, eat well when I went to visit my dad, and my mom took care of me, but she was a waitress, and you know, we didn't have money. So there was a lot of risk in the environment. You know, a lot of drugs and bikers and lowriders, which is like pre-cholos, they used to be called lowriders. Mm-hmm. They had longer hair with hairnets, you know, the Latino gangbangers, you know. When I moved to LA, I was like, why do they all have shaved heads, you know? It's a new thing. And that was in the 90s. But yeah, so when I was a kid, I had a very dysfunctional family, and you know, there was a lot of drugs around the neighborhood. And in that culture, I think what kind of happened now in retrospect, looking back, was when the summer of love ended and Haight-Ashbury kind of came to a screeching halt because hard drugs came in and all of that stuff, a lot of the hippies migrated north and sort of just, you know, made these encampments and communities up there in those towns like Sebastopol and
Marin.
Guerinville and Marin and all those places where I grew up. And so there was just, you know, there was a lot of like drug smuggling and just gnarly kind of dark energy up there. And as a sort of response to the lack of family, I guess, in a sense, and what was there was pretty dysfunctional, the response to me was going to survival mode and just get deeply into drugs, which I did when I was a kid, you know, in elementary school. And so thankfully I had that to save me. Which ultimately became my demise, but that was in lieu of, you know, going to a psychiatrist and getting help and getting on meds or having some kind of therapy. It was just like, wow, the adults are kind of checked out to a degree. And so
self-medicate.
Yeah. And that's how I took care of myself. And then also when I was young, I discovered music, you know, and that was like my, I think my first spiritual experience really was listening to Jimi Hendrix and Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and just smoking weed and just going into these other realms and, you know, riding my bike around the country. And, you know, I had some fun, but there was also, you know, the childhood was punctuated with some traumatic experiences. So fast forward to 1989, when I was 19, I moved to Hollywood because I was super into music. And San Francisco was kind of the city that you moved to where I grew up when you were ready to flee. But San Francisco was so sleepy and boring and there wasn't really a great music scene at that time. So I came to LA and ended up, you know, meeting a bunch of my childhood rock and roll heroes and hanging out with them and doing drugs with them and just had a blast. Got a fake ID when I was 19. And so there I am living in Hollywood with my fake ID, playing in bands and doing copious amounts of drugs because I didn't have to be accountable to my parents. And I didn't have to have a job because I could just sell drugs to support my habit. And I had a lot of fun. You know, I was a good looking kid and the older girls liked me, you know? So I had all these older friends and that played in bands and stuff. I was like 19, 20. They were all like 30. And I had like these girls that sort of took me under their wing, would take me out to clubs and stuff. And, you know, I mean, it was just insanely fun. But at the same time, early 90s in Hollywood was pretty sketchy.
Oh, yeah.
I lived behind the Chinese theater.
I can't even imagine. What was Vine and Sunset like?
Yeah,
then?
That's like where I lived, you know, on Orange and Hollywood. And there was a lot of crack in that area. And heroin, not so much. You had to go to downtown LA, which was kind of a hassle. But
I think you still do.
Probably, yeah. I eventually figured that out. found my way eventually. But yeah, you know, it's just, it's one of those things where, and people that are no longer doing drugs and drinking like myself have a similar story. You know, I think it's said like it was fun and then it was fun with problems and then it was problems and then it was problems with problems and it was that kind of thing. But what had started out as a really fun, innocent, I'm going to move to Hollywood and be a rock star and do tons of drugs and be free ended up being really imprisoned within addiction and just a lot of really depraved situations that I put myself in and just like, oh, even now certain streets I drive by, I just go like, oh, God, like the memories are just imprinted, just dark times of just degradation and just the lowest of self-worth, you know, just.
Absolutely.
Even like when you're in a really low place like that, at least for me, there was still this small voice that was kind of going, you're better than
this. Yeah, there's more meant for you than
You know, because I'd gone to this sort of reform school, boarding school when I was 14 for 2 years in Idaho. It was kind of this cult, weird sort of brainwashing, self-help-esque kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. It was fucking bizarre. But in there, I got some sense of who I was and some sense of truth and salvation. And I sobered up for 2 years from 14 to 16. And I didn't, you know, I stopped committing crimes. And I was, you know, before that, I was having all these problems with police. And they were going to send me away to kids' prison for a long time and all this stuff. So I got out of there and I had a sense of who I was. And I just didn't realize that I was already a full-blown drug addict. So from like 16 years old to 19, moving to Hollywood, I had started to dabble and all of that stuff. And then it got super, super dark and still realized that, oh God, I'm not supposed to be doing this. I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing, but I knew it wasn't that.
What was your come to moment where you realized like, I have more meant for me than this, or your spiritual experience that made you go and get sober?
There were two actually. There were a bunch of them. I'll give you the main ones. There was kind of a long drawn out period from maybe 93 to 97 where the hard drugs started to really take over. And I would try and quit one of them, and then it was like whack-a-mole, you know? Whereas when I went to treatment, they said, you were switching seats in the Titanic. That's what they call it, you know? In the end, the ship's going down, you know, kind of thing.
But, doesn't matter which one you want to do.
Yeah, but that was, you know, that was actually really scary because I thought that I'd have something beat. I would get off heroin and be like, okay, cool, I'm never doing that again. That was a nightmare. And then I'm like, you know what? I'll just smoke crack, you know? I mean, this was the logic that I had. And so there was a long period of that, of just like, God, just getting defeated over and over again, trying to quit. And I just couldn't, or to moderate. And just like, my dream was always to just smoke weed. It's like, I would fine with quitting drinking and quitting hard drugs, but God, I've got to smoke weed.
Yeah.
And so there was a battle for a few years of trying to like wrestle myself, you know, my willpower into allowing that to happen, because that medicine was actually pretty good for me. I mean, I was not very productive and forgot to pay bills a lot and stuff, but I wasn't terribly destructive when I just smoked weed. It was the other drugs that got me to just be in really sordid places with dark people and just, you know, super bad news. So there was that kind of long period, and that progressed and progressed to where it got to be like, oh my God, I can't make it a day without all of this stuff. And then in the end, I'm just doing everything all at once, all the time, 24/7. And that started to feel like, it felt like I was a slave. You know, that's what, because
you didn't own yourself anymore.
Yeah, when I became free, I didn't even know what it felt like to be free, which is the next story I'll get to. But I didn't know what it was like to be free. And once I was free, I was like, holy shit, I was enslaved. I really was. I was just completely under the spell of some little powder or pill or something, you know, that my whole life revolves around, like a $20 piece of fucking garbage, you know, from some field in Mexico. You know what I mean? It's just like, wow, this is the sum total of my life at 24, 25, 26. So there was a couple pivotal moments where I had an awakening. And it's funny because I didn't remember this first one for a long, long time, but it was actually a psychedelic experience. Now, I was trying to just get high and party. I used to sell mushrooms. I didn't realize they were also like in the same class as cocaine and heroin and stuff. So I could have gone to prison. I didn't know that. I was like, what? Shrooms? No big deal. It's like weed.
It's like weed. Yeah.
Schedule one.
You thought it was
schedule one.
Misdemeanor.
Yeah. Because I would never sell hard drugs because I was super paranoid of going to prison. So I just sold weed. And then I sold mushrooms for a long time. And someone's like, dude, that's schedule one. If you get caught with 5 pounds of mushrooms, you're going to prison. So I ate a bunch of mushrooms one night in this apartment building where I live called Disgrace Land. And,
the irony.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's been torn down, which I was so happy about. One day I drove by and it was a parking lot. When they redid the Chinese theater and did all that and made it nicer, I was like, oh my, thank God that building is gone, because I had so many horrific memories. But anyway, I'm on shrooms and I was talking to my buddy, Repo, this guy from Finland, and we played in a band together, and he was like wanting to party and get drunk and smoke weed and just be on mushrooms. And I started having a goddamn meltdown. And I remember saying to him, I was like, dude, I can't do this anymore. I gotta stop. I can't do this. Like, there's something else I'm supposed to be doing. And I was just crying and crying and crying. And then, you know, of course, woke up the next day and was like, okay, where's the drugs? That was a nightmare, you know? And so shortly after that was the first little awakening where I started, man, I'm getting close. It's like when you watch a cartoon and the characters are in a little boat going down a river and they're about to go over the big waterfall. It was that kind of thing. And I got the sense like, oh shit, the waterfall is really close.
What was the waterfall for you?
Getting physically injured, like out on the street. I had a few close calls where like I was just blessed to not be hurt, you know? And then getting in trouble with the law. I think one of my biggest values is freedom. You know, it's something I've always really fought for in many regards. So the idea of prison is just the ultimate antithesis of one thing that I really value more than anything, which is just the freedom to move about the world. And so I was really afraid of going to prison, and I was starting to get a lot more sloppy. I was pretty clever at avoiding the police. I wasn't like America's dumbest criminals. Like, I used to have friends who would go downtown and buy heroin, and they would sit and do it in the car right on the corner they got it. And I'm like, you dumbasses, even if you're sick, you got to make it back home, you know, and have it like in your mouth so you can swallow it if you get pulled over. I mean, there's all these protocols that dope fiends develop.
Yeah,
and some of them are fucking dumb. And so I wasn't that dumb, but I was starting to get that way because I was becoming so desperate.
Reckless,
and just like mentally deranged and all of that. Just kind of mental illness started to set in. It's funny being so graphic with these stories, but whatever.
It's great for the person who's out there struggling. You know who you're probably one of the biggest expanders for is my mom,
really?
Who's like still heavily, really suffering with addiction. In fact, she had a rock bottom happen this last holiday, and I think she's going to go to Betty Ford on the 1st of February.
Oh, God, I hope so.
Me too. So it's actually really expansive for somebody out there.
Well, you know,
it makes me emotional.
It took me a long time, actually, to talk about things this candidly because I've had a lot of shame around it. It's like...
Everybody does.
One side of it is like, it's sort of sensational. You could be like, well, I'm fucking badass. Like, look at this cool stuff I've been through. I'm a survivor.
I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's like maybe a little ego fodder in that you have, you know, a rich history that's sensational in that way. But for me, it was like, I hesitated talking about things in this much detail because it was just like, God, I felt like kind of a loser. You know, I had so much shame for all of those years to finally come out to people like outside of the realm of my inner circle in recovery and stuff. But then as I started to do it, I would like drip out a little more information and then I get feedback from people.
Yeah.
And I get DMs all the time from people like, oh my God, I'm sober 2 years. You're such an inspiration.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and so that's why I'm just kind of like, you know, whatever, man. It's like it's not my life anymore. And perhaps if someone hears that and they're like, oh my God, I'm the one that shoots up at the spot downtown
Totally.
I'm that dumbass. I just got out of jail, you know, to know that there's a way out. And there's such a, I mean, God, you want to talk about a different universe that I live in now. I mean, it's like, it's just.
Yeah, it's from like Vampire Land.
You know, we can get into that, but my whole soul experience on the planet is just, I literally live in a different universe than I used to, you know.
It is actually such a depiction of vibration, like truly, the unseen of energy and frequency and vibration. You're somebody who has lived at the spectrums of it and throughout. So it really is so true that you live in a totally different universe, attracting completely different things versus that point. But continue.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, now at this point in my life, the thing that's fun about it to be able to kind of dip into this and go back there, you know, to tell the story is there's so much contrast. You know, I feel like, God, I've lived a lot for someone my age. There's so many different sort of...
If only you were a writer.
Yeah, right?
You're a biohacker, but if only you were a writer.
Well,
and
you know,
so
it's funny, actually... Durek introduced me to his book agent recently.
Good.
Yeah. And I was like pitching her a couple ideas. She's actually the life story. I was like, I don't know if anyone would be interested in this, but here's a couple of the touch points. And she was like, dude, that's an amazing story. That's your book. You know,
yes.
I was like, okay. I just feel like there's a bunch of like, you know, I survived drug addiction books. So, but I guess each story is unique. So anyway, what happened was there was two major turning points. One was I had... You know, specifically with the opiates, I had really, really struggled to stay off of them. And every time I would quit, I would do kind of what I called a train spotting kick. And that's where you like pay someone to lock you up somewhere where you don't have access to a vehicle and you can't get, you know, it's like drug buddy rehab, you know, like I would be with someone who was a drug addict. They're still doing it, but they wouldn't give me any, you know.
Yeah.
And so I did one of those and it was like in... Oh God, like some really heinous hot part of the valley, Tarzana or something like that. Yeah. In this really scummy apartment in my drug buddy's house. And I was rolling around on the floor there. There was no bed, just on a gross carpet, just kicking, taking copious amounts of pills that were not opiates, but that would like knock you out, drinking alcohol, anything I could do to just like be super loaded to not notice the withdrawal of the heroin.
Yeah.
It's funny because Byron Katie, who's like one of my favorite teachers, she has a similar story where she woke up and came to and there was like cockroaches crawling on her. And that was what happened for me. They weren't on me though. They were just around me.
Yep.
And I was like so weak. I couldn't really get them out of the way. And I'm sort of half conscious just going like, wow, this is my life. I'm on a dirty goddamn carpet in Tarzana. And I'm down here with the roaches. Like we're in the same space here. You know
Completely.
What I mean? Sharing space with cockroaches in the valley. And that was the moment of surrender. And I got on the phone with my mom. And oh man.
I look at Mark right too. So it's okay.
You know, it's so funny. It's you know, it's 22 years ago that happened, but it's like I still just have such a visceral memory of what that was like because it's like I've been fighting most of my life. You know, I've just been fighting and fighting and surviving and surviving. And I just wouldn't relinquish control, you know, and that was the moment where I was like, I am spent. Like, I literally have no answers left because you know, I had no money. I knew that I was going to come back to Hollywood and I was going to get $20 together and I was going to get well. And then I'd be right back there again, but I literally had nothing. And then the next thing is, you know, you get robbed, you get arrested, you lose your apartment, you become homeless, you become a street person. And I was like right on the verge of that, okay. You know? And so that little voice that I was saying was like, no, you've got to do it. And so, yeah, I called my mom, God bless her, and she had the wherewithal to get me into a rehab. And so,
wonderful.
Yeah, 2 days later, I'm on a plane from LA to San Francisco, just getting shit faced, like pounding tequila the whole time.
You're like, is it sort of that, like, I'm going to binge before I go on?
Oh, God. Yeah, leaving Las Vegas, man. Totally. Yeah. I made it to the San Francisco airport, drinking on the hour flight, just like chugging whatever I could. And then in the San Francisco airport, I went to the bar and I kept drinking and I almost missed my flight to Santa Rosa. Got off the plane there. And yeah, it's funny. My mom, I thought I was going to go to my mom's and like party for a few days. I had this idea. She's like, okay, cool. Yeah, great to see you. Let's go. You're checking in tonight. And I was like, whoa. No, not tonight. I'm like, in a few days, you know?
Yeah.
So I sat in the Santa Rosa airport and got really shit-faced. And yeah, I kept drinking all the way out to the rehab out in the woods and had my last drink and my last, like, I was like hyperventilating big spliffs in the parking lot. And I knew that was the last one.
You did inside your body?
Yeah, that was it. It was my last, I knew it was my last drink.
Wow.
Yeah, in that parking lot, some really good beer, some microbrew beer.
At that state, I had her
stop at the liquor store on the way there. And okay. I was like, I'm not going to have my last drink be, you know, Milwaukee's best or something.
Yeah.
Like,
a 40.
So I got some King Cobra 40. I got some great beer and I just pounded and pounded and then checked myself in. And the next, you know, real pivot point there was that I understood by that point that I couldn't help myself. And I also understood, I mean, I'd been to a couple 12-step meetings and I was aware that that's where you kind of go, but I was not very interested in that route.
I don't think anybody is that I've ever met. Because I'm obviously surrounded by so many people in recovery and addiction in my family, but even my mom just went to a meeting a week ago and she's like, of course, I sit down to the homeless guy that's like starts yelling out and freaking out.
Right,
and it's a very small town, so there's nobody that inspires. I've never met somebody who's like, oh, I'm so stoked to do AA.
Yeah, people don't go to 12-step meetings because their life is on point.
Yeah. Although I've known a few in LA because really? There's a scene. Continue.
Yeah, but this is really, I think the single most profound moment of my life was coming to February 15th, 1997 in that rehab and going to the nurse or, you know, the counselor and being like, I'm super sick. Like, you guys got to give me something. Can I get a shot of something? And they took my vitals and they're like, no, you're good. We got nothing for you. You know, it's like, okay, what am I supposed to do? I'm freaking out. And they said, well, you get on your knees and you pray to God.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, what? No, you get some Demerol prayer? You know, I was like, are you serious? So even though I kind of knew that was coming, I thought it was going to be an easier sort of transition and I'd have some help there with the physical part of it. And I didn't. And I'm so grateful because I literally had no choice but to just ask whatever God was, which I was not really raised with any religion or anything like that. I think I was probably a bit more interested in the Eastern path and, it, you know, picked up a couple books on meditation and, you know, Vedic philosophy and things like that. Some of my family had been going to India and having pretty profound spiritual experiences. So, you know, I had an idea that I could approach spirituality from that place, but I had definitely never prayed before.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was that like your first time?
You know, I mean, I was so out of it. I don't remember exactly. I just remember kind of just to get the mechanics of it physically. Like, I'm like, okay, I think you put your hands together and then
completely.
You get like at the foot of the bed. And I think, you know, it's just like, how do they do it on Little House in the Prairie or something?
Yeah,
you know, I was
like
thinking of movies, like pray. Okay, so you do this. And yeah, and my prayer was just like, I think they gave me the words probably because it's not words that I would have come up with, but just God, please remove this obsession.
Mm.
You know, just I want to be free. Just God, just make me sober or whatever the words were. But I think really why it worked is I was just completely humbled and I had just completely surrendered and I was totally out of answers. And that's the, that's the sweet spot where source can really get in and do its work, you know,
when there's no more control.
Yeah. It's that, you know, it's, we're given this amazing gift of free will. And if you want to go be a pedophile serial killer, go nuts. Mm-hmm. No one's going to stop you. Mm-hmm. I mean, you
well,
know, God's not, yeah,
yeah.
God's not going to stop you. In other words, you know, we have the spectrum from the lowest of low energies to the highest of the angelic. And you can play around within that realm here on this plane.
Yeah, the physical plane.
Yeah, and so I was allowed to do whatever I wanted, and I did, but when it hurt enough, you know, that's the great thing about this loving God that I experience in my life. It's like I didn't have to do anything to earn the grace. Mm-hmm. I just had to be humble enough to say, okay, I realize that you've given me this will and I've used it. I'm now handing it back to you. Mm-hmm. I'm good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It's like, exactly. Yeah.
I am so done, and I will do anything I have to do in order to maintain, you know, sobriety. And then in that moment, I was set free. You know, it's just from that moment until this moment now, I've never ever once remotely considered doing drugs or drinking. I've never had a craving or compulsion that was strong enough to get me in motion toward it at all. I mean, sure, you know, the odd fantasy or I'm sure when I was new, I was so uncomfortable. I was like, God, I wish I could just have a drink.
Something, and
I would drink near beers and shit, you know, sometimes. Yeah. But I never was compelled like I used to be. I was set free. And so the past 22 years has really been about, you know, really just expanding that phenomena into other areas of my life, you know, into finance, like we've talked about, and into sexuality and relationships and into unraveling other traumas that were sort of revealed later that I didn't even have. Yeah, that I didn't even know had affected me, you know. And so it's now more about allowing that surrender experience and allowing myself to be guided in all areas of my life. And I've had to cling to some of those and really hit bottoms in other areas too where I become willing. Like you and I've talked.
That's where the magic, I mean, the magic happens.
Yeah.
What would you say your biggest rock bottom was? Was it during that time?
I mean, I don't think it gets much worse than the cockroaches in Tarzana or Reseda. I mean, that's.
I don't know if it's the valley that's worse. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No offense to anyone living in the valley, but you know, in 1997 and whenever that was, January, super depressing. Oh,
there's
my
like
God.
Porn being shot in the next.
Yeah,
room.
Yeah, totally, totally, the porn capital of the world. You know, I think that was really, I mean, it was those years were just a long drawn out bottom, but that moment was the moment that was just like, yeah, no, this can't go on. But there's been a lot of them, you know, there's been a few, you know, there's been moments with money and debt and just not being in control of that area of my life. There's been moments of relationships that were painful and not healthy. So I think in all the different areas of life, there's been, for me at least, I have to get pretty uncomfortable before, again, I'm willing to really surrender that part of my life. Mm-hmm. Like if you come to me and say, hey, Luke, you know, this is how you should relate romantically and this is how you should approach your sexuality, I'd be like, I'm having fun, do it at my way. I've got this shit figured out, which is what I thought through, you know, my 30s, I would say. And, you know, and then at a certain point, finding either that's becoming dissatisfactory or painful or just unfulfilling or empty, and then going like, huh, well, again, here I am out of answers, and then start to explore wisdom in those different areas and then start to actually invite a higher power into all areas of my life, which is where I am now. And it's so interesting, you know, going back to what I was saying about things are so different. It's like, now my entire life has been surrendered.
Mm-hmm. You know, all areas.
Yeah.
Because I even got to watch you in the relationship field. I'm watching you in the financial field. Like I've seen you even, and you really are like surrendering to all of those, and magic's happening out of them.
Oh, it's insane. I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's so funny about the human will and about the ego is it's
totally.
The ego is so funny. It's like watching my dog. You know, I always look at animals and you can see ego. It's like they think they're so clever and you're going like, I know what you're doing right now. You know, that's the ego like thinks, oh no, I've got this all figured out. I know what I'm doing. You know, it's like, no, you don't know what you're doing. You're serving the lower self. And so, yeah, I have surrendered that. And what's so funny about it is all the ways and, you know, just say like love and romance. Okay. All the ways in which my ego and my psyche tried to protect me so that I wouldn't get hurt actually ended up hurting me more than getting hurt.
Always.
And becoming vulnerable, you know? And so now, you know, exploring a new relationship as I am for the past 3 months.
Which I'm
discussed.
So excited about.
I am too.
I'm glad that we can talk about it a little.
Oh, I'm fucking thrilled. Yeah. And what I'm experiencing is just surrender after surrender after surrender. And then I become afraid and I'm not going to succumb to the fear. I'm mustering up every ounce of courage I have to just go in fully and just be 100% vulnerable. You know, I mean, it really feels, even just physically, I feel the vulnerability, just like, God, just stick the fucking knife in. Just get it over with. It's because it started to become so painful to withhold that experience from myself and from others.
It's so interesting to me too. I mean, I think everybody has a form of addiction they've had to overcome in their life. May it be sugar, to negative self-talk, to, you know, whether it's substance. I mean, there's just such a spectrum of it. But what's so interesting, a lot, obviously, I believe that addiction occurs for a couple of reasons. It's like unhealed trauma that needs to be addressed. You're trying to protect ourselves from things. But essentially, what it does end up becoming is a form of living on the edge when it's out of control, right? But the ultimate point of living on the edge is that full surrender. There's nothing higher and scarier and crazier deeper than that.
You're not kidding. Yeah, you're not kidding. I just went on a trip for a few days out of town, and yeah, I experienced, you know, in the romantic sense of vulnerability and just taking a risk, you know, it really is like front seat on a roller coaster kind of feeling inside. And I'm just like, no, hang on. Don't let go. Don't let go. Don't let go. Don't close. Mm-hmm. Don't close, you know, because that's what fear does. That's what ego does. But it's actually just not intelligent. You know, that's the thing. Like I'm saying, that the cleverness of the ego and all the games it plays to hide and, you know, obscure reality
or project and all the things.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. Yeah. It doesn't achieve the desired result of the soul. It gets in the way. So it's like while the ego is, its intentions are good, it's just not very effective, you know? And so, yeah, even just in the past week, I mean, I've had incredible surrender experiences just going like, nope, I'm not giving into this
shit.
So
much magnetism, I can guarantee, is on its way because of that.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is also just surrendering my will in terms of just timing too.
It's huge.
You know, having taken such a long break from dating and all of that and just going like, I'm done doing it on my schedule. And then there'd be fears there. Yeah, but you're getting older. What's that gray hair? And, you know, whatever.
Completely.
You know? And it's just like, no, I don't care. If I'm 80 when I come out of this shit and then I try to date, it is what it is.
You absolutely. Know? But, and it'll be deep.
Yeah, but at a year and a half, it was like, okay, cool. No, I feel I trust my source. I trust that relationship. I trust the guidance. And more than anything, I trust myself.
But
and
you're
so,
ready. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just been so amazing because my initial experience now, which is, you know, still new and limited, has just been so expansive and beautiful, and it's so much better than anything I could have come up with intellectually had I like self-willed it, you know. So I'm sort of just watching God's handiwork going like, really, this is what I get for, you know, I want to say being a good boy, but it's not the right way to state it, but it's like, this is what I get for surrendering and stop trying to control fucking everything and protect myself, and also what I get for accepting a little bit of prudence and discernment in the ways in which I enter into relationship and the people that I choose to enter into those with, you know? So yeah, it's a really magical experience that I'm having right now because, as I said, just so many different areas of my being have just been like put on the table and I'm allowing so much to be released. It's fun to observe as myself going like, wow, let's see how this sort of personality can be relinquished and surrendered and see what comes to replace it. And what
it's almost like,
it's insane to watch.
Yeah. I think it's the ultimate high because it's the true self-discovery. And also you're doing it through another, which I think doing it together in partnership is what speeds up. It can just speed up spirituality deeply. It's so profound.
It sure seems that way.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You guys are only 3 months and this is exciting. I'm so excited for you both.
Yeah, it's a wild ride.
And Cookie.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you the question because you are serving as such an expander for overcoming, you know, addiction and recovery and now all the other facets of your life that you've also been kind of approaching in the same way. You know, you've rock bottomed, you've surrendered. What have been for you the biggest tools that have brought you to this state of being? So like the person who's sitting there listening, they're in their rock bottom, what would be, because you're the ultimate biohacker, like spiritual seeker when it comes to food, everything, if you were to kind of come up with the 10 things that have been the most profound since you've tried most of them, what would those be?
Well, for me, the experience of just getting sober initially was all about
aligning myself with spiritual principles that were present within the 12 steps. And, you know, in the very beginning, it was like, cool, just get physically sober and then act like a goddamn maniac and do whatever you want, which is prevalent to some degree in some circles of recovery. It's like, who cares what you do? As long as you're sober, yeah, you're good. You know, you got in a fight today in traffic with some guy and road raged and got arrested. Cool. Did you drink? You didn't drink? Oh, you're cool. You know, I mean, that's kind of like, you can do that. How many hookers did you bang last year? You didn't drink though, right? You know? So it's sort of anything goes. So there was the anything goes period, which is like, hey, I'm cool. I'm, you know, I'm not on drugs. So therefore I can do whatever I want and still lived in a lot of self-will and a lot of insanity. And there's just, you know, the repercussions of that much emotional and psychic damage and just mental, like physiologically the damage you do when you're using certain drugs and stuff. So in the beginning it was like, cool, just stay sober and just hang on to recovery and the community in recovery and all of that. And then after a few years of that and life still being really unmanageable and still like looking from the outside like a drug addict, you know, it's what they call a dry drunk or a fire hazard, as I referred to myself for a period. You're so dry. You're just like irritable and crazy and just fucking nuts, you know? And you're like, are you really sober? Well, no, there's emotional sobriety. You know, physical sobriety and emotional sobriety.
And spiritual sobriety.
Yeah, and financial and sexual and all those things. But to give people resources, I mean, I don't know of anywhere else really in the world where there's such a wholesale experience of effectiveness in terms of recovery than within the 12 steps. And it's something that I talk about sort of cautiously because you have the principles of anonymity within 12-step programs and, you know, it's just, it's like if you're a movie star, right? And you're like, oh, I'm so, you know, you're a total fuck up. You're Robert Downey Jr., whatever. You're like, oh, now I'm in AA, right? That's just breaking a tradition within AA. And then someone's like, oh, cool. Wow, AA must work. And then that guy relapses and ends up back in court. You're like, that discredits AA. Or if someone, you know, misbehaves in other areas of their life or, you know, is just a jerk, then that sort of tarnishes the name of AA or whatever 12-step group. So, you know, it's weird to sort of talk about, and I've had to just find ways to dance around it. But within the traditions, I can just say, like, right now, if you're listening to this and you're struggling with an addiction, find a 12-step group that fits your addiction, just period. That's the only thing I've ever seen work in a large-scale way. And if you look at, actually, if you really zoom out on recorded human history, the 12-step movement that started in 1939 is the only thing that's really ever worked in a long-standing way. There's, you know, there are these
micro communities.
Yeah, and like white light experiences people have. I mean, I know of a musician who was a heroin addict for a long time. And one day he was in his room sick and Jesus came in his room and manifested and told him to stop doing drugs. And he did and he never went back. And now he goes to like the mega church in Orange County and he's very happy and has a family and he's sober. That's very rare though, that people are able to find it through therapy, through church, religion. It happens, but it's just very rare where I find most of the people that have hit a significant bottom and really avail themselves to a 12-step, not just the meetings, but the way of life and actually integrating the principles is pretty much foolproof to me. So I think the physical sobriety part is the beginning, but then where a lot of people miss the boat in recovery is the emotional sobriety and understanding of getting to the root causes of why you drink.
I believe that.
And even people outside of AA think, oh yeah, that's those like weird groups in the church basement where people go to quit drinking. But that's not what it is. To me, the 12 steps are about learning how to live by spiritual principles so that you're fulfilled and on purpose. And when you're fulfilled and on purpose, you don't have a desire to drink because you're happy, you know? So it's like, you've got to get to the underlying causes. And within that, I think once, at least I can only speak for myself, but, you know, giving references is like, once you have that foundation and you're living with self-honesty, you have some degree of humility, you have a willingness to grow and to learn, you've made restitution to people that you've hurt, you're dealing with your character defects, your anger, your fears, you're identifying ego, you're learning how to disassociate from negative self-talk. You know, these are all things that are inherent in the 12 steps, meditation and prayer, surrender,
community.
That's acceptance, community, unconditional love, being of service to people, like making your life about other instead of about you, which is what the narcissistic addict does. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to be that way. Mm-hmm. If you're dope sick, you can't. I'm not going to go work at the goddamn homeless shelter. Like, I need $20 right now yeah. and a ride downtown.
I feel like since you've used, there's inflation. Is it still just $20?
I don't know. I mean, back in my day, you could get well
for
20
five
bucks.
Cents. It wouldn't last. Not getting. Yeah,
it wouldn't last long, but you could get well for $20. Okay. Actually, you know what?
It probably is.
At this one car wash on Hoover in Washington, you used to be able to get $8 balloons.
Wow, was the special.
Yeah, and those would they get you well for an hour or two. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress. But beyond, you know, just the foundation of a 12-step group, whatever, you know, fits your poison, so to speak. I mean, then there's so much to do in terms of your spiritual growth. And even within Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, it's right there in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. We highly encourage you to go seek outside help.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I've went to a place called Onsite in Nashville that's like a, you know, whole like childhood trauma, work through all that shit. I've done the Hoffman process. Mm-hmm. I've gone to Tony Robbins. Mm-hmm. I've gone to India on 21-day mm-hmm. silent retreats. I've done Kundalini yoga for coming up on 8 years now, Vedic meditation for about that long. Mm-hmm. So anything and everything to me that I can use to unravel trauma and get that out of my way. Mm-hmm. And then to deepen my relationship with God, mm-hmm. whatever God is.
I mean, yeah.
I hesitate to use that word. It really freaks people out, but I'm becoming less apologetic. It's just like, I don't know. To me, on one hand, it's like if someone's that freaked out about God, yeah. you haven't hit bottom. Like,
yeah.
All right, go spend, you know, go rack up more debt, go cheat on your wife more, go do more crack, whatever, you know. It's like, to hit a bottom, you got to get to the point where the word God doesn't bother you, I believe, honestly. And in the beginning, you know, funny of AA, I've studied a lot of AA history just because to me it's, again, we don't see it now because it's embedded in our culture. But in 1,000 years from now, in the annals of history, we'll look back on 1939 and you'll see this huge spike.
The
entire self-help movement was launched by Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just an absolute phenomenon in terms of human behavior. Mm-hmm. And in the history of AA, it's really funny because when they would go, the first two guys that founded it, you know, they both got sober by just talking to each other, and they were able to help one another because they understood what other people outside couldn't. You know, mm-hmm. your local pastor is not an alcoholic, like they don't get it, so you can't listen to them. Mm-hmm. Your wife might love you, but she's just nagging at you. She doesn't understand that you really need that drink. And mm-hmm. when you got those two guys together, like, hey, this is how I feel. And he opens his heart and says, man, this is how I feel too. Let's help each other. Once they discovered that and they were both struck sober, they went out to mental hospitals and started to kind of like try and convert alkies, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, because back in the day when AA started, it was very low bottom cases. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like now where, you know, you have a couple of rough weekends. Oh, I had too many glasses of wine. I'm going to go to AA. Back then you're on the street. You've lost everything, you know, like bums, like literally like bums, you know? So they'd go around to these churches and they would interview the guy in the mental hospital when he would come to from the delirium tremens and all that. And they'd say, you know, okay, so you got a drinking problem. Yeah. And they go, well, are you ready to surrender your life to God? And if the guy was like, no, they go, well, good luck. Bye. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had to surrender on the spot. They'd want to hold hands and pray and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was not religious, but it was very like
spiritual.
Yeah. Deeply and spiritual. Not esoteric. I mean, it's like, no, God's the only thing that can save you. Do you want that? Yeah. Yes. Okay, cool. Let's do it. And then it would work. So it's interesting in that perspective. So I think you do have to hit a bottom and you have these deeper levels of surrender. But within that, you know, there is the negative side of like sitting in AA meetings for 35 years, mm-hmm. not doing any other work and just having your ego build an identity around like, I'm an old timer in the meeting. Yeah. I sponsor 15 people and I still hate my life, mm-hmm. you know, which is like that dry drunk thing. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the pitfalls that I think is wise to look out for. And that's why delving into some of the other approaches to spirituality and stuff will help one avoid the risk of being concretized, you know? Because that happens sometimes. You start to build an ego identity around being a sober person and the milestone of whatever year you've hit. And at one point, I kind of just had to let go of all that. Even recently, sometimes I'm like, well, I say to someone, well, I'm 22 years sober. And mm-hmm. I'm like, maybe I don't even have to say that. Maybe that's not even a thing anymore.
It's just another form of ego in a way. You know what I mean? I love what you're saying.
It's not even like I'm bragging about it. No. I still identify as a sober man. And it's like,
and as a separate in a way.
It might not even be necessary to have that identification.
Totally.
It might just be like, hey, we have a dinner party and you offer me some wine. I'm like, oh, no, thanks.
Yeah.
Like that might be the story.
Totally.
You know, it's not like, well, no, I haven't had one of those in 22 years.
My friend Ashley Neese wrote a really excellent piece on her blog for anybody who is looking for a resource of exactly what you're saying. And I think I'm going to paraphrase the title a little bit or chop it up, but why I don't identify as Alcoholics Anonymous anymore, why I'm just sober, or why I just don't drink, or something like that. And it was a really beautiful piece of exactly what you're talking about. My whole intention this year has just been getting hyper mindful as much as I can in the present. And, you know, and I love what you're saying, and this isn't to go against somebody who's identifying, but I think I'm really starting to get so interested in not identifying as any. I'm an Aquarius, so I'm one for like no labels in general. So I'm starting to take that so much deeper, but I love what you're saying is, the more that we disidentify as anything in a way is the more we become a collective and oneness and all of that. And so I just love that you're saying, be careful of that particular pitfall that you can't go into. And you know, there are many avenues you can take to deepen your spirituality while in that program.
There's a lot of ways in which you can get stuck in recovery, because the ego likes safety. And so it'll build these sort of constructs. And you'll arrive at a certain place of understanding or development, and the ego will say, let's pour concrete on this. Let's stay here.
Yeah.
Danger lurks on the other side of another awakening, so let's stay here. And for some of us, like myself, that stuckness gets so uncomfortable that like, oh, I got to have another breakthrough, and you keep pushing through and pushing through. And my ultimate goal as an entity here is just absolute merging with God and enlightenment. So I'm not going to get stuck in like, oh, credit cards. You know, it's
No.
We got to go way beyond, you know, where I want to go in terms of evolution. But another thing I want to touch on too, which I think would be useful for people, is you have the spiritual framework, right? Which allows you, whatever your chosen modality is, let's just say something like Vedic meditation, right? Or any kind of meditation that's really effective where you have a technique that's not just like,
I'm sitting here letting go of my thoughts, focusing on my breath.
Well, you know, any kind of mindfulness meditation where, I think when Eckhart Tolle's first book, The Power of Now, came out, that was also a huge pivotal moment for me in my recovery, because it was very much in alignment with the 12 steps. The 12 steps treat alcoholism as a mental illness. And the problem is not the alcohol. The problem is that you have an insane mind that tells you that either, fuck it, life's not worth it, I'm going to drink, or it tells you, you know what, I could probably just have one drink this time. But it's a mental illness. It really is.
Yeah.
It's that negative self-talk.
Well, even on a scientific level,
that,
like how your neural pathways start to convert in terms of survival, it becomes like an obsession and a loop. I mean, absolutely.
Your
brain changes.
Totally. And that's, you know, in that book that I reference, Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the things that was a huge turning point for me and then sort of developed into the Eckhart Tolle approach. I still want to say Eckhart Tolle because when he first came out, that's how everyone said it.
I know.
But now like people say it right. So I feel like I have to conform to Tolle the right way. It looks like Tolle on paper.
Yeah.
But in that book, it says that glass in hand, we warped our minds. Actually, no, that's in the 12. The 12 and 12 is another book they call it. But yeah, we warped our minds. And I remember reading that and someone pointed out to me like, Luke, you have a warped mind. You get a parking ticket and you think about it for fucking 5 days and that's all you can think about is how you're going to get back at them and, you know, whatever. I mean, just insanity. And that's a minor example, but I would just spin out into all of this negativity and self-talking and just... it's an obsession of really what alcoholism is or addiction. It's an obsession of the mind in a very global sense. It's just... If you're drinking, it's on like another whiskey. If you're a sex addict, it's on another prostitute or pornography or whatever. But once you stop the behavior, you still have the obsession of the mind.
Yes.
It's just going to choose, like for me, when I got sober, it was like spending money. I would go, we had this store called Circuit City back in the day, you know, in the prehistoric
times. I
remember
Circuit City.
Yeah, my first credit cards, I was just like, I need to buy five VCRs. And I would just go like run up my credit cards and just get high on the shopping, you know? And it's like, God, this is so, I'm so pathetic. And I was so desperate just to change the way that I felt because my mind was creating a world and a reality for me that was so uncomfortable. So once you get past the point of using exogenous sources to change your reality, then, well, I don't like to preach, but it behooves me to find ways within myself through my spirituality to change my perception of life.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like right before I got sober, it's a great story. It's probably too late to digress and tell it now, but one of the things that led up to me hitting bottom was I was at a party and I was drunk, shocker. And my friend had a Rottweiler, he was my pot dealer. And I was fucking wasted, and I was like slapping the Rottweiler kind of on its hind quarters, you know, mm-hmm. like you do. And the Rottweiler was like, really? Fuck you. Boom. And he bit me on the face.
Wow.
Yeah, I have scars right here still. And that led to, you know, I had to go to the emergency room, and then, you know, there was a lawsuit, and I got all this money, and then I spent all that money on heroin. Mm-hmm. And there was all these things that happened that were, you know, quote unquote, negative or positive. And it's funny now because it's like every little thing that happens in my life now is really viewed as a positive.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that, see, I used to have to do drugs to change my version of reality. I got the parking ticket. Oh, I got the divorce. Someone died, someone's ill, whatever. Okay, I'm going to ingest something, whether it's, you know, something that gets you high or, you know, the high of spending money, you know, whatever it is, whatever your high is, right?
So
I have to use that to change my perception of reality. But through practices like meditation, Kundalini yoga, I can actually learn how to observe my thoughts mm-hmm. via the power of now, you know, getting that framework where there's a me, which is my higher self, my soul, who I really am, that's embodying this 48-year-old male sexed meat suit. Mm-hmm. And I get to watch my personality right now as mm-hmm. we speak. I get to watch my thoughts, watch my ego. There's a separation, you know, there's a witness experience mm-hmm. that starts to happen. And there's a little crack in the armor there, you know, and some light shines through. And you say like, oh shit, there's a me. And then there's a thought. There's a me and that's watching the thought. Well, who's the one watching the thought? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's where you start to really play with the malleable reality that reality really is shaped by my perception of it.
Completely.
So how can I now find practices, teachers, et cetera, that really build the skill of within myself and my own awareness, changing my perception of reality, not into a false reality, but actually to be in alignment with actual reality.
Completely. As present as possible.
Yeah, and actual reality is, thank God that Rottweiler bit me on the face.
Totally.
That was the best thing that ever happened
to me.
Totally. I mean, really, that was one of the peak moments of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, it was traumatic. It hurt. It was scary. But it was necessary.
Totally,
you know?
Necessary.
And it's like, you could ask 100 people, hey, Luke got bit on the face by a Rottweiler, good or bad? You have to judge it. You have to label it bad, 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 all the way down mm-hmm. the line. But if you know the whole story and the arc of the story and what that led to, you would have to say, if not neutral, that it was positive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, so it's learning how to gain control of your mind so you don't have to use drugs or other medications, whatever they might be, to do it for you.
Yeah.
And that's really what it is. And there's so many resources available. Aside from the metaphysical realm, something that, you know, I'm really into the health and the biohacking and stuff.
Well, also sharing because, you know, you have had the luxury and it wasn't a luxury at the time because you've obviously paid for it, like the Hoffman Institute's $4,000 mm-hmm. and like being able to fly to Tennessee and do these other things. But for the person who maybe doesn't have that accessibility right now, because you have so many resources on your site and links we can go to, as well as I know Kundalini is accessible at least through Rama TV online.
Totally.
$14.99 a month if somebody's wanting to practice. I personally practice Kundalini as well, or for the person who's interested in Vedic, it's a one-time training, and then you have that mantra and you can do it. What are the others you were going to mention?
Well,
I do practice. Yeah, I've been practicing that.
I want to give a shout out to my teacher, Jeff Kober, who's a Vedic meditation teacher.
And also sober.
Yeah, and a great actor. You know, people like I turn him on to people, and they're like, "I saw that dude on The Walking Dead." I'm like, "Yeah, he's cool. He's a cool guy." But yeah, he does something interesting with the Vedic. He just charges a flat fee of $1,000 now.
Oh, great!
Because in the Vedic tradition, it's like it's always been on a sliding scale, and like you have to give a week's pay, which for some people, a week's pay is $100,000.
Yeah.
Some people, it's $100. You know, it's just I always thought that was kind of weird. It's like that TM, like TM is kind of weird in that way with the payments and stuff.
Financially, I think it turns
a lot of
people
off. Got me a little funky. And anyway, I talked to Jeff a few months ago. I was like, what does it cost? And he was like, you know what? I got tired of all that shit. It's $1,000 for everyone, whatever.
Awesome.
You know? And that's 4 days of training. So
yeah. And it's a lifetime of a practice, truthfully.
You could pull up an armored car right now and go, Luke, here's $1 billion mm-hmm. cash. We're going to give it to you right now, but we're going to remove your capacity to meditate for the rest of your life. There's no way I would take it.
Yeah.
There's nothing that I value. Well, there's things I value more than meditation, but it's something that I could never live without.
Yeah. I love it just as much. Yeah.
So other resources. Well, what I wanted to really talk about was, now that I know so much about health and about hormones and neurotransmitters and circadian rhythm and all these things, you know, you're a fan of Jack Cruz like me. now when I meet anyone that's sober and they're still suffering from depression or anxiety, or they're on meds, they have insomnia, really what's going on with most people is they're low dopamine.
And that's an epidemic in society.
Oh my God,
in
yeah. We're going to look back on this time period of all these devices that we're all addicted to, the blue light that's coming off your iPhone, your iPad, your computer, the flicker rate of all the LED lights that's brainwashing us and damaging our eyes and our brains. So,
and the lights in the street, I mean, it's
all of
everywhere.
It. Yeah. So if someone is like, yeah, I don't have $5,000 for the Hoffman process or whatever, what do I do right now? And this sounds, I have such a hard time getting people to do this shit because it's free mm-hmm. and because it's relatively easy, they won't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so simple.
True. Yeah.
If you get up every morning
yeah.
and watch the sunrise for the first 20 minutes and look at that red light.
And if
the sun,
you're naked on top of it.
Yeah, yeah. And grounded.
Awesome. Yeah,
and grounded.
In the earth. Yeah.
Yeah, but really, I honestly, again, like looking at the big picture of where we are in terms of a species right now, we are zoo animals.
Oh, completely.
And we are domesticated in these homes where we're cut off from natural light. We're cut off from the elements that are hot and cold. Our nervous systems are so fucking weak.
Oh, man.
Emotionally, we're so fucking weak. Like with... especially the generation that's in the room looking at us, no offense. It's like, I've hired like millennials and I say like a word and they're like,
No, these guys are great. They're like love avoidant. They're tough. Oh, okay. These are tough chicks.
Want to hear a funny story? Yeah, so yeah. I had an employee working for my fashion school and I have an Amazon Prime account. So I was thinking about this a couple of days ago because I was using one, but, she had gone in, you know, I said, we need to order extension cords or whatever, computer hard drive or something like that. So I gave her the login for R, which is my Amazon account. And I had ordered some condoms mm-hmm. online, which is like, yeah, I'm a fucking adult. Like,
yeah,
whatever,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like I'm ordering sex
toys.
Oh,
no, you guys must see, I order the weirdest shit all the time. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because Lila gets the notifications totally.
So
yeah.
I didn't know, but a few months later, after that person no longer worked for us, my partner, Lauren, was like, oh, yeah, dude, like she got totally freaked out when she logged into Amazon. She was like having a fucking panic attack, got all weirded out because she saw that you'd ordered condoms. I'm like, dude. We are too fragile.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, this is a problem.
And it's such a double coin, too, because it's like so responsible. And there's just so many. I mean, it's such a conversation. I mean, as a society in general right now, everything that's happening, even with like call out culture and stuff, which there is such a need for transition and change 100%. But more than anything, and I think that's what you're going to pivot into, we need to fucking strengthen our subconscious and nervous system and stop making it about the outside world and start to empower ourselves individually.
Yeah. It's a victim mentality, you know, and that's not to say that there aren't victims.
No, absolutely. Everyone's a victim.
And
in
I'm
a way.
All for empowerment, but self-empowerment is the number one empowerment.
That's where you get your power. Yeah. Damn it. That's where you see
and
change.
And if you don't have that, then you're going to go around trying to solve all the problems in the world without
projecting.
Being very effective.
Yeah. 1,000%.
But where I was really going was really in alignment with nature. You know?
Oh, okay.
And this has, well, no, it's all part of it. It has to do with your emotional resilience because it has to do with your nervous system. And that's one thing that's great about Kundalini yoga. It really fortifies your nervous system. So when the flight gets canceled, the person breaks up with you, the whatever ad infinitum, that you have the resiliency to go like, okay, wow. Taken aback for a moment, but here I am, I'm back because you have your breath.
Absolutely.
And if you can use things like sun gazing, grounding, cold thermogenesis, aka ice baths, infrared saunas, getting out in nature, staying connected. That's what really builds your nervous system because that's what gives you voltage.
Totally.
You know, and what's happened is we're just completely domesticated now. We're living in artificial light and all of these EMFs from the Wi-Fi and the cell towers. And I mean, it's just like, we're not living in a natural environment. And so that has a lot to do with how, especially the sun and our relationship to natural light, not just sun gazing, but even just being outdoors more.
And the sun, yeah. And this crew knows about it because I talk about it so much.
Yeah, I mean, like right now we're sitting in here and it's the afternoon and there's daylight coming in. So
and we have blue light hitting us.
Yeah, but if I asked you, I was like, hey, are we getting natural light today? You know, someone would be like, well, yeah, look, there's a window. Right there, but see, windows cut out half of the UV spectrum, so we're actually
UVB, right?
Yeah, so we're actually getting a diffused fake light because think about it, in nature, glass doesn't exist.
Totally, absolutely.
You know. And so, if you think about our relationship to light and the sun and the planets, especially people that listen to your show, they might be aligned, you know, with astrology and understanding where we fit in the universe and the solar system. our bodies are literally solar panels, mm-hmm. and they're computerized, electrified solar panels. And that part of us is what controls our mood, our neurotransmitters, our hormones, our impulses, our ability to be happy, our ability to love and to be loved.
It's, to absorb nutrients.
Yeah, like, all of that.
Basic, yeah.
All of that. And so that's the thing I get, you know, because I sling supplements on my website. And I mean, there's $12,000 devices you can get that I have that are awesome. And I love all that stuff. Yeah. But for people like, yeah, but I don't, you know, where do I start? It's too confusing or too expensive. I'm like, if you just get in the sun and you get an ice bath,
eat a couple oysters.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, some fish.
Get some DHA. Yeah. It's like your life will change. And if you stop blue light at night, which is a commitment, people have a hard time with that. You have to adjust your devices. You got to change all the lighting in your house.
Or you can just be like us here. Poor Max, we have blackout shades and it goes candlelight at dusk.
Yeah.
That's it. He has an electronics
That's the best.
Room.
I mean, that's the best. Yeah. And, you know, what sucks is we're so habituated to the domestic zoo animal life that we live. It's like when I was just on this trip with my lovely lady friend, you know, she put up with me, but we checked in the Airbnb and I was like, cool, okay, I got out all my light bulbs.
Yeah.
I pack like amber light bulbs, and I changed all the light bulbs. And she's like, really, dude? We don't know each other that well yet.
You know? You're crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, listen,
you're dedicated.
2 million years of evolution.
Yeah.
And I'm not going backwards. Yeah, if we have to shoot something, cool, turn on the blue lights, whatever, I'll live. But it's like...
It's a choice, yes.
It's not insane to change the light bulbs in your house. It's insane to fucking look at blue light in
all
a spectrum
day.
That doesn't...
Sitting down.
And it doesn't even exist in nature.
It doesn't.
You know, those lights we're looking at right now and the lights on our phones, that's not what the sun is.
It's
the
a
sun,
full spectrum.
Yeah, and so...
I do want to do a mini plug for anybody listening because it's about to launch, but each of the retreat houses, I will say like confidently, that's why you have to come and host something at one of them. But the one in Yosemite, especially, there's zero light pollution. It has a creek. There's natural water nearby where you can plunge.
I was obsessing on your stories last night.
We have an infrared sauna there, a biomat there. I mean, it's going to be literally this, how to get you back fully to nature, and then you get complete access to all of the workshops.
That's so beautiful that you're doing that. You're like, you're a step ahead of me on that dream. I'd love to
do something
like
that
too.
Yeah.
So I'm quickly interrupting this episode that I hope you're finding very expanding to tell you about a special offer that you won't find anywhere else but here. So with the code JOURNEY, that's capital JOURNEY, simply put that in order to receive your first month off free for the pathway or 10% off any of the a la carte. And once you're in the pathway, there's a suggestion of exactly what you should follow, starting with the formula and magnetism workshop, moving into reparent and shadow, and then you'll move through, if you're calling in a career, opulence, you'll move through partnership if you're calling that in. And of course, everybody should be doing the daily reprogramming exercise. The beautiful thing about the pathway as well is that you will have access to the Facebook group, which is the like-minded community you've probably been manifesting. And it gives you access to all of the Unblock villages that are meeting up around the world. So you'll be able to find one in hopefully your neighborhood. And you get full access to my class, which is twice a month called Supported, where you can write in any question you're having about your manifestation process or manifestation in order to have me answer your question. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
You know, I guess you could say coached or mentored a lot of guys, you know, that are in recovery and things like that. And, you know, there's the spiritual realm and there's the metaphysical realm and all of that. But once I get them doing cryotherapy, ice baths, sun gazing, grounding, they get off meds, they start sleeping, they don't have anxiety anymore, they don't have depression.
Yeah.
They just lose all these issues.
They start to balance.
Oh, yeah. It's fucking crazy. Yeah. If someone comes to me and they're like, dude, I'm on meds and I'm, you know, it's ruining my life. What do I do? I'm like, well, I'm not a doctor. Don't stop taking your meds. Keep working with your doctor and tell them you want to wean off. But if you start doing the natural protocols and get in that environment,
you'll be supported enough.
Then all of a sudden they're just like, yeah, that just went away. That's not a thing anymore.
Totally.
You know, and I'm not recommending someone go
off
their
meds.
No. I would never be that
irresponsible. I've actually seen people do that and it's really, really unsafe.
Oh, yeah. I was on psych meds. In early sobriety, and I was a fucking, oh my God, I was a train wreck, and I tried to stop them and I got really crazy.
I have to segue into one other thing too. When Eckhart Tolle, I think this is actually a really interesting thing to note for people because of wherever we might be at. But the first time I attempted to read that when I was, it was in 2008, and I was like working as a waitress at the Laugh Factory, so poor, the lowest self-worth on the planet at that point. I remember being in my bath in my East Hollywood like studio apartment with cockroaches that lived with me and trying to attempt to read that. I was actually talking to my friend about this the other day and I was like, is this in another language? Like my consciousness was not at all able to comprehend like what, how, huh? You know, like this is crazy to me. And I also kind of don't even understand what's being said. And then I just revisited it over the holidays and continue because that's sort of my whole intention this year. And I'm like, oh, this is so easy. Not easy. Granted, it's a practice.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And I will have to credit that to Kundalini and Vedic meditation and all of these things that we do.
I've had that experience too. There was a book that was gifted to me before I was sober. It's a really thick book. It's called I Am That by Nisargadatta Maharaj.
Wow.
And it's deep non-duality.
Mm.
Eastern mysticism kind of stuff, Indian. And I remember I would read the back cover.
Alone.
The back cover. And I would just be like, there's something in it. I was like, this is the shit. I don't get it.
Yeah.
It was something about like, okay, say there's a building. I have the book. I think I read that part on my very first podcast, Return of the Jedi, number one. But it's like, say there's a building and then, you know, the ages come and the storms come and the building is gone. Would you say the space is still there? So is the building really there? You know, one of those kind of things.
Totally.
And I was like, whoa,
like if the
dude.
Tree falls, did anybody?
Kind of thing. And I'd be super high just going like, whoa. But then I would open the book and I'd be like,
I don't understand anything.
There's something here. And I knew there was. Yeah. Fast forward 15 years maybe of picking up that book again and going like, oh, duh. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I just want to take that note too for anybody listening. Like, and this doesn't have to be, you know, an investment of so much time until you can kind of hit these spaces. The information that Luke's giving you here and now, where you might be at in your life, it doesn't have to be, you know, like you're in recovery. It can be anywhere where you're just sitting and you're like, what do I do to kind of get a hold on reality in a way and also presence and then also health to match so that we can be happy and present and accept things and surrender, you know, the simplicity of just starting exactly those free things you were talking about, your meditation practice, whatever it might be. These things open up our consciousness to be able to go to these next levels. And I think that, I mean, obviously anybody who's doing Unblocked, you're really addressing childhood and all sorts of stuff that I think that it's anything that's going to help you feel homeostasis and worthy. That's it. That's the answer in many ways.
Totally.
And that's basically what you're telling people. There are very accessible places to go with this.
You know, another thing too worth mentioning, and your guided meditations are awesome for this too, by the way. Yeah, I was just actually talking to Rhiannon that I was mentioning earlier, and she does your course too, by the way.
Does.
She loves it. Yeah. And she's like, oh, I just listened to one of Lacey's meditations. I'm like, I know those things are deep,
dude.
I'm
so happy. Yeah. Also, I have to let's give a shout out to her because I just saw your picture in Santa Fe and I was like, what's that weave that you're wearing? And then I clicked and I saw her work and I was like, oh my God, I need those cropped.
Ghost Dancer. Amazing.
At Ghost
amazing
Dancer.
Artist. Yeah.
Incredible weaver.
Yeah,
so
her
go check her out.
Instagram is The Ghost Dancer. Yeah.
At the
amazing
ghost dancer.
Artist, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, we were talking about your program, and I'm like, yeah, I'm super into the theta vibe, like that. Float tanks are like my favorite thing ever.
Yeah, my fiance's too. I can't stand them.
Oh, really?
But he loves them.
Yeah. So any kind of like binaural beads or float tanks, or when I do neurofeedback, by the way,
so
is expensive.
Powerful.
But for anyone suffering from PTSD trauma, neurofeedback is really, really
and
effective.
And EMDR is another plug.
Yeah, I haven't done that yet. I want to try that. But anywho, I love those things that just kind of really take you into that space. So for someone who's challenged by meditation, you know, listening to guided ones is a really good place to start.
I agree.
And to help you like get lift off until you can just kind of do it on your own. But I have to say for me, it's something that's been really profound and continues to be in terms of just reprogramming my whole psyche is listening to audio. So I got the Power of Now on CD back in the day, and I would listen to Wayne Dyer and Stuart Wilde. And
a lot of this you can find for free on YouTube.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And even podcasts like the Ram Dass podcast is insane. I mean, I've listened to every single episode.
Don't listen while driving, man, to any of them. You're
many of them over and over again.
They're so relaxing.
There's a lot to be, I mean, you can really learn a lot from audio. audio, so good. And it's something, you know, like this podcast here that you can do while you're engaged in something else, but it still sinks in. So that was a huge part of my reprogramming too. It was not only reading in a compliment, like a contemplative, studious way, if that's a word. Like, just, I mean, when I would read spiritual text, it's like I'm reading it one word at a time, going over maybe one sentence 20 times.
To absorb,
I mean, like, not, oh yeah, I read that book. No, like, I'm going to read a book for the next 10 years. Like Emmett Fox, Sermon on the Mount.
Completely.
I read that book almost every day for 15 years. And it's a short book.
Yeah.
There's not that much to it.
Yeah.
But it's just, I would find these nuggets, you know, like one of his principles is about enemy soldiers, that negative thoughts are like enemy soldiers. And if you let them dig and entrench into the field, they're really hard to get to.
Yeah.
But if you can pick them off as they present themselves, you know, you can win the war, something to that effect. But it was a great metaphor. And so, yeah, and then that just integrates into my mind. You know, I wake up and like I spill the smoothie in the kitchen and I'm like, oh, see, so annoying. I hate life. And I'm like, enemy soldier.
Yeah.
That's the first one. There he comes over the ridge. He's trying to dig his foxhole.
Yeah.
I'm like, fuck you, enemy soldier.
I'm
not going there. I'm like, wow, what a great moment to like play with this green dye on my floor, this spirulina. Wow, it's really beautiful. You know, let's make some art. It's like,
yes.
But yeah, I would just say, man, for, you know, for people getting down with like the really enlightening audio is huge too.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. I listen to a ton of it myself driving still all the time. Yeah. Not still, like I've arrived anywhere. Yeah. I'm such a work in process.
No, of course. Yeah. Of course. But it, you know, there's tools that are useful for a time and then you kind of let them go. And then there's tools that kind of just remain. And for me, the audio has been that way. And I guess
so
probably
digestible.
One of the main reasons I started a podcast is I was like, wow, I'm listening to all these people. I could be sitting down and talking to them and sharing them with people that might not have discovered them. And I would also like to shout out my all-time favorite spiritual teachers, a man named David R. Hawkins.
Oh, the best, And they're very familiar too, but continue with that.
Yeah, and that was one that I found, I think The Power of Now, God, I probably found that, I don't know.
Was Letting Go your first?
No. The Power of... Not The Power of Now. Power
versus Force.
Versus Force. And that one I got. And the reason I liked it is because he was friends with Bill Wilson, who's the co-founder of AA. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and David Hawkins was... When he died, he was sober like 55 years
or
something. Yeah. And so he was there in the early days when Bill Wilson was doing LSD and Hawkins was a shrink and he was friends with Harry Tebow, who was Bill Wilson's shrink. And there was all this trippy... It's when the spirituality of the new thought movement in the 30s merged with psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this really interesting thing.
Which is magic.
Yeah, there was this really interesting thing that happened. And David Hawkins was kind of at the forefront of that. And he was a psychiatrist in New York City for 50 years.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. I used to go see him speak in Sedona. And he treated thousands of alcoholics. And he had it down. And then he went like way beyond the beyond with it.
Yeah.
But his other books, including the last one, Letting Go, that one is probably the best entry point. I'm glad you talk about it with your people because it's so deep, but the way he wrote that one is so much more simple than his other books. His other books, one of his books is called The Eye of the Eye, I think Reality versus Subjectivity.
Mm.
And that's like that book,
Dense.
I Am That, where I got it and I'm like, I'm like just one word at a time, you know?
My brain's melting.
It took me 2 years to read that book.
Wow.
And I read it almost every day because I'm like, I don't want to read it. So, I read that book. I want to read it so I can internalize it. And then now I go back and I'm like, oh yeah, I totally get that.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Expands.
But there's a lot of audio you can get of David Hawkins too. And
he's
just
great.
Had a really amazing framework for the human experience using his scale of consciousness, you know, from the animal kingdom going up into the angelic realms. And so it gives you kind of a marker of where you might be, which affects, of course, all of your relationships and finance and mental health and emotional health. And it gives you something to sort of strive for that I want to get to the upper levels. And so you'll be aligned at different times in your life with different teachings that calibrate at a different level that might be appropriate. That's why, you know, the 12 steps are a great entry point because they're based on the principle of unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the 12 steps are. It's like, come here, man. We'll love you, you freak.
Which
coming
is
off the street, you know what I mean?
Principle of being present. It's kind of the foundational principle of a lot of things.
Yeah. Right. And then once that's in lock, kind of what we're talking about later, then, oh, wow, let me, you know, study some teachings of the Maharishi or do the meditation and that. And then there's higher realms that wouldn't be accessible to the kid who's like 22 and just getting off crystal meth. He's like, what? Maha who?
Yeah.
You're going to fucking meditate?
Yeah.
But I'll go to a meeting every every day and smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
So I love Hawkins because he gives you a really wide spectrum of experience. And it also, he's so great at, he died, but he's so great at giving an explanation as to why there are these dark forces and evil energies in the universe and that it's all God.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, oh, God is over here in the light.
The polarity.
Then, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That, you know, it's like, it's like Yogi Bhajan said, if you don't see God in all, you don't see God at all.
I believe that, that's just called shadow work, man. And back to what we were talking about before, and fragility, and just nothing outside of you matters in a way. It's everything inside of you. That's true shadow integration. You know that it's not that. That's actually me, and I'm that, and we're together, and we're totally connected. It's that true integration of shadow.
So yeah, and to have compassion for shadow too, you
that's
know,
because the huge,
it's so easy to look at, you know, the world stage of politics and social issues and even going back in history and thinking, oh, they're bad. You know, now we have this political climate like where it's like, I hate those people that hate people.
Yeah, I know.
But this more of the same, you know. So Hawkins had a really great way of just explaining the different calibrations of consciousness and that there's different humans or at different points on the scale and that they're all innocent.
Yeah.
Even the ones on the lower scale. Because
and that we all go through them.
Yeah, and they believe they're doing the right thing.
Totally.
And the most evil human you can imagine, in the moment of their evil, they believe they're doing good.
And they just, exactly.
It doesn't make what they're doing good
it
or acceptable.
It doesn't make it okay. But
you can have compassion for their suffering because they're coming out of their own pain.
Absolutely.
And their pain's being inflicted on others. Not to say that they shouldn't be stopped, not that you should condone, you know, anything that harms anyone else, of course, but I don't know. I find that having, like, again, a more zoomed out worldview makes me take all the little nuances of our societal problems a little less seriously.
Like, absolutely.
I don't feel as compelled to go save the world in that naive sense. It's more like, how can I bring light right now when I walk in 7-Eleven?
Yep. Yeah, or on this podcast. Maybe,
you know, the 7-Eleven would be a starting point, but it's like that.
I mean, I just don't see you even going into 7-Eleven.
Actually, I don't. I don't know where that
even
came
that.
From.
I like that metaphor. Wait, I have an even bigger question.
Yeah.
I fly to Ireland tomorrow, or I'm flying to Paris, then Ireland tomorrow,
oh,
and I know
God.
That you're coming out with a course that I'm super stoked about.
My nemesis. Travel.
Is it to Europe? You hate that flight?
Just, you know, I say, like, I love going to different places,
right.
But I hate traveling.
I heard this when you were talking to Dr. Jack Cruz on your podcast, which is a great episode. You have two of them.
Yeah, another one. Him. I have another one with Jack Cruz coming out in a month or so.
Were trying all the angles. You were like, but I plugged my biomat in. He's like, it's still plugged in. You know, so I just tell us about your course that's coming out.
Well, it's just selfishly because for the past 22 years that I've been exploring all these different alternative healing and health modalities and supplementation and practices and devices, and now this thing they call biohacking, kind of like learning and understanding your own biology and dealing with that yourself rather than taking it to a doctor to fix it for you. One of the things I have not been able to fully fix, I guess you could say, is the negative effects of travel. Mm. When I fly specifically, and especially on really long flights, I just get completely wrecked. And so if I'm traveling for business, I'll have to buffer an extra day of recovery and like pay for a hotel, rental car, whatever, just because I can't fly in somewhere and be normal.
Yeah.
I'm just totally tweaked. Going on a vacation with a loved one or family or something, it's like, again, have to book extra days in the beginning of the trip and once I get home to just recover. And so I've been working for many, many years at putting together really all of these different practices, which might include taking supplements or different devices, and then also just how to get in alignment with the circadian rhythm and to beat jet lag and things like that. So I finally just last year started documenting on video all of the wacky shit that I do when I travel. I mean, if you see me get on an air, I wish I could bring a video crew on an airplane with me. And
I
like,
bet it's just you
watch
must
me
look nuts.
Set up my JetBlue Mint seat, you know, with all my shit. And I actually, one of the hacks is like, go on trips half as often and fly first class.
Oh,
like,
yeah, honestly, I do. Like, yeah, I did business this one.
I can't. And I'm not trying to be like highfalutin. I just like coach.
You need to be able to sleep and
coach
stuff like
is a
that.
Miserable experience. Yeah. You know, I know that's not accessible to everyone for a lot of my life.
It
there's
wasn't
no way.
For
yeah,
me
Yeah, I
either.
Mean, are you kidding me? I was lucky to even get on a plane at all. And then put me in the fucking cargo department. You know?
Totally.
Even a seat in the back was too much for a long time. But no, that's part of it. But I just have all these practices. And then finally, I started just doing mini bits of content about them because people would ask. They'd see me on the airplane doing an Insta Live or something of a supplement or this thing I'm plugging in. They're like, what is that? What is that? So I started making longer form videos and then eventually came up with like what's a couple hours worth of content just on every single possible thing you could apply.
Amazing.
From free ones like, you know, sun gazing, especially when you land in a different time zone.
Yeah.
No matter how tired you have to get up, get your bare feet, hopefully on wet ground, not on a city street ideally because there's electric
currents. No, in Paris
it's
like
stuff.
The park. Yeah.
Yeah. And looking at the sun. So there, you know, there's ice baths, there's saunas, there's all that. But there's also a lot of supplements and a lot of different devices and things like that you can use. And there's, of course, like a scale of, you know, how much those things cost.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Some of them are free and some you have to spend money on. But yeah, so I just decided, I've always wanted to do an online course and I don't want to do something that someone's already done. There's a lot of great information out there already. And I thought, well, I don't think anyone's as obsessed with fixing travel as me because it fucks me up worse than anyone I know.
Yeah.
I fly to New York with my business partner, Lauren. We get off the plane. She's like, cool, I'm going to Barney's.
That's how my partner is.
I'm like, what?
I know, I'm just
I'm
like
going
you.
To sleep for 3 days. Like, what are you talking about?
Totally.
I can't find the baggage claim. I'm all disoriented. I'm dizzy, irritable. I mean, I'm just a freaking wreck. And so I'm like, God damn it, I'm fixing this. And I have systematically, like piece by piece by piece, made it better and better all the time. And so,
I cannot wait for this.
Yeah, so I'm finally.
Yeah, tomorrow I'm like doing business class was the one. I'm going to like drink 8 ounces of my water with chlorella for every hour I'm on the flight. I'm doing compression socks.
Yeah,
I'm doing
fasting.
All the things. If I have sun in Paris, I'll do that. But
the compression socks are good. I just wore those on my flight yesterday and I have a compression shirt and EMF blocking clothes.
Wow.
Is another
so
cool
it's
thing
metal.
Too. I have these Faraday, these like slacks that are a Faraday cage.
Okay.
So they have this metal thread in them that prevent RF frequency.
Wow, that's probably what messes everyone up the most.
It is. There's really high EMF. You know what really sucks I learned from Jack Cruz actually is that he only flies on planes without Wi-Fi.
He does.
Yeah, and I'm like, but I want the Wi-Fi.
I don't use it. Yeah,
he'll book flights just specifically so they don't have Wi-Fi.
Wow.
And also, I don't do this, but one of the best hacks is flying at night.
Yeah, that's what I chose as well.
Yeah,
so I can do red glasses the whole time.
And less solar radiation. There's just less weird electrostatic in the atmosphere
at night.
But I just don't like, it tweaks me too bad. Just like the sleep rhythm gets too weird. But the compression clothing is really good. I have an EMF blocking little beanie.
Wow.
You know?
So see, we have so much to learn. This
there's
is
a lot.
Great.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that you can do. Now, some people that get bothered by it less, they'll do less. They're like, cool, I'll just do the sun gazing thing to beat
I'll
the jet lag.
Eat the thing or not eat the thing, like whatever I'm supposed to
but
do.
But there's a lot of cool stuff you can do to make it less brutal. Yeah.
Okay, we'll share that in the show notes because
cool.
that's exciting.
Yeah,
and anything else going on that we should check out?
What else is going on right now? I don't have a date, but I do have an event at Rama in Venice coming up, which is called the High Love Experience that I did in October in New York, and it was a big hit. It was amazingly fun for me. I turned it into a podcast episode, so I'm going to complete that workshop again there.
Okay.
The same format, some Kundalini yoga and some inner work. It was pretty powerful. And then I'll have one coming up here in the next couple months at Sacred Space in Miami too.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so I'll be doing in 2019. I want to definitely do some more workshops. And, you know, because I do a lot of speaking where I drop in, you know, paleo effects or like these big conferences and I go to a talk. And that's fun because you can reach a lot of people. But I like more intimacy. I'd rather take 30 or 40 people and like we're going to have a goddamn experience.
Deep,
not just, a PowerPoint of like,
information.
Here's how to be happy and healthy. But like, let's do some stuff more experiential. So
that's exciting.
To doing that. And when you're up and running, I want to come to
you. Oh, you have
I
to.
Do something at your
it's
space.
Going to be
yeah.
your haven.
Yeah,
you're
this
going to
place
love
that,
it.
I'm telling you, last night I was like stalking your stories. I was like, oh my God, this place is a creek?
Yeah.
So dope. And the river nearby.
I know. Well, there's two. So like one's always running. It's a three. I know you'd find a spring right away too. That's like the next mission is finding a spring. But the water's very sulfur rich. So there has to be some hot springs that are undiscovered. But so you have the Yosemite melt off May through like October. They have a river that runs through that's a freshwater river, and then there's one that's always running. It's a 3-mile hike in the backyard. It's insane.
Oh,
so you're
going
best.
To be that's the best. It's so inspiring. That's like my dream.
Well, yeah, I can't wait to have you there. And we're so grateful you showed up today and came and spoke
with
us.
Me too. Oh, man, me too. I was excited to ask. I like your show, so it's cool to be on it too.
Well, I like yours. Great. Go check out those episodes. If you haven't listened to them, go check out every episode.
The last one you did was really great too. I mean, it's funny when you, and I'm sure you experienced this too, but I don't think people quite grasp, well, maybe they do, but I get the sense not to the depth that I do, but how much I'm actually learning and listening to people in an interview. Like when we did that one, for me, it's like I'm cheating and having a private session with you. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to call it a podcast. You know what I mean? Oh yeah, it's for other people. But really, I'm like, all right, how do I fix this shit, Lacey? Yeah. And that one was really good. We had a couple of breakthroughs when I was looking at like my what are they called? Blocks?
Yeah,
around money and stuff. And I discovered a couple of them, but even just in our conversation on that interview with you on my show, I forget which one it was. I think it was about like spirituality and money.
Totally. Then,
like,
that's
huge. If you're a sober person, you're supposed to stay humble and just be spiritual, and you can't have,
if you're like religious, it's you know, thou shalt not want. It's
greed. And that was one of the ones I was like, oh my God, I've been carrying that for a long time. So
I'm glad.
So I encourage people that, you know, obviously are following your work to go check that out, because you get to just really cut loose.
And it was such a fun episode.
Yeah,
and
I think
Cookie sat with me the whole time.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Well, thank you so much today, Luke.
For
and
sure.
We'll definitely be linking that course, because I have a speaking tour this year. I need those hacks because it wrecks me just as much as you're talking about. Yeah. Travel is so hard for me.
Yeah, some of us are more sensitive. You know, it's weird. Mm-hmm. Same thing with EMFs. You know, some people that doesn't seem to, I mean, I know it hurts everyone, but some like they're aware of how it bothers them, which is kind of me. And I think that's a lot of the flying, but there's all kinds of crazy stuff you can do to help.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you.
For sure. Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everyone.